Well, let's turn in our Bibles to the book of Matthew in chapter 24 and verse 1. Tonight we finally get back to our studies here in the book of Matthew. We stopped, I think it was October 10th or something around there, so it's been a few months as we've taken a break, and yet this evening we return to our studies. It's a very complex passage. I will say I probably won't answer all your questions. So if you have questions, if you want to talk about it some more after the sermon, always happy to do that. So please feel free to talk to me if you'd like. Chapter 23, obviously, is the immediately preceding passage. That was Jesus' last public discourse to the multitudes. If you remember, Jesus is saying, "Woe to the scribes and Pharisees." He's denouncing the Jewish leaders for their rejection of him, and he actually forewarned them of the judgment that was soon to come upon them. Back in verse 34 of chapter 23, Jesus said, "Therefore, indeed, I send you prophets, wise men, and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar." And then he says in verse 36, "Assuredly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation." And then down in verse 38, he says, "See, your house is left to you desolate." And then in the beginning of chapter 24, Jesus continues right on with this theme, but in speaking of it to his disciples. And so this is the final discourse. If you remember, there are five main discourses in the book of Matthew. This is the last one. We call it the Olivet Discourse, given that Jesus talks to the disciples on the Mount of Olives. And so let's read now God's Word. We'll start here at verse 1 and we'll go to verse 35. This is the Word of the Lord. "Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, 'Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down.' Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?' And Jesus answered and said to them, 'Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. That if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, 'Look, he's in the desert,' do not go out. Or, 'Look, he's in the inner rooms,' do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near, at the doors. Assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. And there we'll end the reading of God's Word this evening. As we look at it, may the Lord give us His blessing to understand it and to apply it to our lives. Well, recently, Micah and I have been reading the children's version of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan. And if you're not familiar with the story, it's an allegory about the Christian pilgrimage that we're all making as we go through this life and go to heaven and all the various challenges that we face along the way. And the story begins with the main character, a man by the name of Christian, who's reading a book. And in the book, he learns that the city in which he lives is about to be destroyed. And it's the city of destruction, hence its name. And so he begins to panic, and he desperately wants to know, what should I do? How can I escape this judgment that's coming? And then this man comes up, named Evangelist. You can probably understand what he does. And he helps Christian know the way to escape is to flee, and to flee now. And not just to flee in any given direction, but to flee to the gate that leads to safety. And you know, that's exactly what we find out, what we find going on here in Matthew 24. Because in these verses, we see Jesus warning his disciples that Jerusalem is about to be destroyed. And that if they don't want to be destroyed with it, they need to flee before it will be too late. And even though from our perspective, the destruction of Jerusalem has already happened, it was back in 70 AD, a long time ago, it points us to a greater judgment to come at the return of Jesus Christ at the end of the age. And just as was the case for the disciples thousands of years ago who were with Jesus at this discourse, so it is for us. We must flee from the judgment to come. And knowing that it is to come, we must warn others to flee with us as well. And so that's our main point as we look at this passage tonight. And just as Jerusalem was judged in 70 AD, so too will all the world at Jesus' second coming. And therefore, flee from the judgment and warn others to do the same. And boys and girls, if you want to draw a picture tonight, thought you could draw a picture of the city of Jerusalem and how there would be some soldiers around the city and how they were coming to attack the city. And it's a scary sight, but that's what Jesus is talking about in our passage. And he wants us, as we think of that, to realize that something far worse is coming unless we are trusting in Jesus, and how we need to be trusting in Him alone for salvation from that coming judgment. Well, on the outline, you'll see our first point tonight is that judgment is coming. And so let's look here at the beginning of the passage of verse 1. Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. I once heard a friend of mine from Northern Ireland recall his experience when he first came to the States and saw all of our skyscrapers. Because being from a land where they have no such buildings, it was magnificent. He could hardly take in the size and the glory of these large buildings. And that's what the disciples are doing here. They're coming up to Jesus, and they're not just saying, oh, look at these buildings. They're amazed. Jesus, look at these buildings. Mark brings that out for us a little bit more clearly when he quotes the disciples as saying, Teacher, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here. So they're overwhelmed by it, not just showing him the buildings, but they're especially overwhelmed because of what Jesus had just said, that this house was going to be left desolate. So you see what they're really doing here as they come to him is, Jesus, look at this place. How in the world is it going to be left desolate? And yet it would be. And so that's why Jesus then says in verse 2, do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. And so he's making sure they realize, as great, as magnificent as the temple complex was, the temple itself, all the other buildings around it, the large, massive stones, as great as all of that was, they will all be toppled. The temple will be destroyed, Jesus is telling them. And so imagine with me, just for a second, if you heard this evening that soon, within your lifetime, America was going to fall as a nation. The White House was going to be destroyed. The Capitol building was going to be destroyed. The Union of the 50 states was going to be dissolved. America, as you know it, would no longer exist. How would you feel? Well, that's what Jesus had just told the disciples here. And so you can imagine they're beginning to wonder, okay, this sounds bad, so how can I get out of it? What can I do? And so that's why then they leave the temple complex, and we see in verse 3 that they come up to Jesus privately when they're sitting on the Mount of Olives, and they say, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And so notice he asks them two questions, and often so much of the debate on this passage hinges around these two questions. What exactly are they asking? So you have question number one, when will the temple be destroyed? And question two, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And usually these two questions are understood by Christians to be speaking of two different things. So in question one, you've got the destruction of Jerusalem. In question two, you've got the second coming of Jesus at the end of the world. But what I want us to see this evening is that when the disciples asked those questions, they were talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in both of them. As we see in the parallel accounts of Mark and Luke, what the disciples really meant by their second question is, what will be the sign when it's about to happen, when Jerusalem is about to be destroyed? Because again, they don't want to be there when it happens. But you see what's going on here is the reason they asked the second question in these terms is because in their mind, the Messiah was only going to have one coming. And it was at this one coming when he would set up his kingdom. He would save his people and he would save his people, judge their enemies, and thereby bring in the end of the age. And the reason they believed this, and we've talked about this in the past, is because this is how the Old Testament prophets had presented it. So, for example, look at Isaiah 35, verse 4 on the back of your outline, where we read, say to those who are fearful hearted, be strong, do not fear. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God, he will come and save you. But the disciples hadn't seen Jesus do what they were expecting him to do. They hadn't seen, he hadn't set up his kingdom on earth. He hadn't judged his enemies. And so you see, they're putting the pieces together. Well, a great event like the destruction of Jerusalem must be the time when he will do that. And yet we realize that they were mistaken by it, because we look at the New Testament and we see that there's a first coming, but there is a second coming. And the first one was to accomplish the salvation, and the second one is to judge the enemy and usher in the age to come. And we need to remember, the disciples, when they were with Jesus, they couldn't even fathom his death, let alone a bodily resurrection from heaven at the end of the world. They had no category for this in their mind. So in their mind, Jesus still had not come as the Old Testament said he would. He hadn't judged the enemies. He hadn't set up his kingdom on earth. And so the destruction of Jerusalem and the coming to do that were one and the same thing. And yet we realize that ultimately they are not. But Jesus here in verses 1 to 34, he answers both of their questions, and he does so as they intended them to be understood. And so he tells them when the temple will be destroyed. If you look at verse 34, Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. It will happen within their generation, within their lifetime. And while we're here at verse 34, that's a significant verse. What Jesus is essentially saying here is that everything from verse 4 to 34, with the exception of verse 27, we'll talk about that later, are things that will happen within the lifetime of the disciples. Very significant for a right understanding of this passage. And then Jesus also tells them what the sign will be when the temple is about to be destroyed. And we'll look at that momentarily in verses 15 and following. But then in verses 36 and following, Jesus continues to answer their second question, but he does so as it should be understood. So in verses 36 and following, he goes on to talk about the actual second coming at the end of the age and when he will judge the world at that time. And what we'll see is that there will be no sign when Jesus is coming back to judge the world, but that instead it will come suddenly and unexpectedly, and so we need to be watchful for that. And that's what we'll be looking at next week. But you see, Jesus' whole point here in verses 4 to 35 is to show his disciples that despite how far-fetched it may seem that the temple of all things was going to be destroyed, it was going to happen. And not just the temple, but all of Jerusalem with it. And he wanted them to realize judgment is coming. And even though his focus here is on the destruction of Jerusalem, it's not just about that. There is still application for us. And we know that because Jesus' words here are prophecy. And like all words of biblical prophecy, there is application for the immediate audience. And so there's application here for the disciples as it pertains to the destruction of Jerusalem that would happen in their life. But there's also a universal application. And in this case, the universal application is the fact that this lesser judgment at 70 AD points us forward to the greater judgment to come at the real end of the age and the second coming of Jesus to judge it. 2 Corinthians 5:10, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad. So that's what he's saying here. Now, secondly, he goes on to say that there are some things that may lead us to think that the end has come, when in reality it has not. And so here in verse 4, Jesus begins answering the disciples' question, and he does so by warning them of certain people and certain events that they will encounter. There are five of them. Some of them are pretty self-explanatory, so I won't elaborate on all of them. But let's look at them. First, he warns them of false Christs who will appear. Verse 4, take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. If you look at Acts 5, 36 to 37, not now, maybe later this evening, you can read of some of those false messiahs that actually came at that time. Second, then, Jesus warns them of wars and natural disasters. Verse 6, and you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. Verse 7, for nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. And again, we read of some of these things in the book of Acts. Acts 11:28, Acts 16:26. Then third, he warns them of the persecution they will encounter. Verse 9, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Now, just a quick side note here. In verse 9 and in the following verses right after it, you know, Jesus says, then you'll be persecuted, and then. And it seems like he's talking about a sequence of events. This will happen, and then this will happen. He does the same thing down in verse 23. It's easier to see in the Greek than in the English, but what we need to realize is that he's not talking about a sequence of events here. He's talking about a bunch of events that will all happen at the same time alongside one another within a general time period. So then, fourth, Jesus warns them of the apostasy and the problems that will take place within the church. Verse 10, and then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. So because of the persecution, some will be offended. That is, they will fall away from the faith. This is usually what happens. Persecution cleanses the church of her fair-weather fans. There will be betrayal and hatred for one another. And Jesus says in verse 11, false teachers will have a part to play in this, most likely trying to take advantage of the Christians, offering them, quote-unquote, better things at the time. And then on top of this, Jesus says, sin will run rampant and Christian love will greatly diminish. But then fifth, and on a much brighter note, he tells them that the gospel will be preached to all the world. Verse 14, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. And here we need to understand that Jesus is not saying the gospel will be preached to the whole world as we understand it before the destruction of Jerusalem. Again, in the Greek, we see he's talking about the Roman world. It's within the Roman Empire that the gospel would go forth before the destruction of Jerusalem. And we see that. You look at Colossians 1:6, for example. Paul talks about how the gospel has gone forth to the whole world. That's what he's talking about, the whole Roman Empire world at the time. So putting all these things together, you'd think that they would signify that the end has come. Right? On one hand, you've got great trouble is happening. And on the other hand, Christ's kingdom is advancing. And in light of what Jesus has said about the destruction of Jerusalem, you'd think, well, these things fit perfectly. It must be leading right up to the destruction of Jerusalem. And yet Jesus wants them to know, no, that's not the case. When these things come, they aren't signifying that the end has come. And we see this in various places here. So, for instance, in the second part of verse 6, he says, see that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. At verse 8, all these are the beginning of sorrows. And then verse 14, the gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. So you see, Jesus' point here is that though these things are terrible and great in terms of the preaching, they're common nonetheless. As you know, every Friday at 11 a.m., I think it is, the tornado sirens go off. 12 p.m., the tornado sirens go off here in Bloomington. And for me, not having lived in Indiana my whole life, although having lived here for 8 years or more, I don't even remember off the top of my head, I'm still occasionally surprised by them. And I hear them, I might be in my office, and for a second, thankfully it's just a second, I begin to think, oh, they're warning me of something here. And then I realize, well, no, it's just a test. It's a false alarm. And that's what Jesus is saying here. You might see these things, you might hear about these things happening, they might instill within you a little bit of panic, but no, it's just a test. It's a false alarm. And so he tells the disciples, don't be troubled by them. Verse 6, don't be negatively affected by them. That's implied here. Don't be deceived. Don't fall away because of the persecution. Don't give up. Instead, persevere through it all. That's what he says in verse 13. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And the same thing is true for us today, because we will encounter and we are encountering these same exact things. There are false Christs all over the world today. Millions of people are following one of them in particular, Muhammad. There are wars today. Just turn on the news. There is persecution today. There is apostasy and schism in the church today. And praise God, the gospel is being preached throughout the world today. But we can't be alarmed by these things, and we can't see or hear them and think, well, Jesus must be coming. Because just as they did not signify to the disciples that Jerusalem's destruction was coming, so too they don't tell us that Jesus' second coming is at hand. They're terrible, they're great, but they're common events that characterize life in this world. And so Jesus wants us to know that to begin with. But then as we see thirdly, when the end has come, there will be no doubt about it. It will be clear for all of us to see. And so let's move on now in the passage and let's look at verses 15 and 16. So Jesus goes on to say, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So here's the sign. Here's the sign that announces the destruction of Jerusalem is about to happen. The abomination of desolation, or more accurately, the abomination that causes desolation, will stand in the holy place. That will be the immediate precursor to the fall of Jerusalem. And as Jesus says, this abomination that causes desolation is spoken of by the prophet Daniel. Now, there's more than one place where Daniel speaks of it, but let's read one of them in Daniel 9. So Daniel 9, 25 to 27 is a notable example of this. We read, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commands to restore and build Jerusalem until the Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublesome times. And after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the Prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate." Now, I know there's a lot there, but we won't go into that this evening, but that's one example of it. And we know from history that an earlier fulfillment of these prophecies about the abomination that causes desolation is, Antiochus Epiphanes IV, who in 167 B.C. Conquered Jerusalem and then sacked the temple, actually sacrificed pigs of all things on the altar and did so to Zeus. But according to Jesus, there's another fulfillment, and it will happen at the destruction of Jerusalem. And we could spend hours and hours trying to figure out what this abomination of desolations is. But thankfully, Luke tells us exactly in his account. And I'm thankful for that. So look at Luke 21:20, where we find the key to this verse. "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near." Right, so it's when the Roman armies show up in Jerusalem, that's the sign its destruction is about to happen. And the Roman armies will be an abomination because the soldiers would carry these emblems, and on them they would have things to which they would essentially bow down before and worship. And they would stand in the holy place because they would come to Jerusalem, the holy city, and then enter the holy temple, and they would cause desolations because at first they would surround the city, trapping the people inside, starving them, and then eventually they would break the walls, torch the city, smash the temple, and slaughter the inhabitants. And so you see what Jesus is saying here. When you see the Roman armies coming close to Jerusalem, it's about to happen, and so you must flee. Verse 16, "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." And you know, in those days, people thought Jerusalem was impregnable. So if a foreign nation was coming to invade, the last thing you would do would be to flee. Instead, you'd go into the city because of the high walls, the big stones that the disciples were talking about. That's where you would want to be. And yet Jesus says, don't hide behind the walls. Everyone else may hide behind the walls, but don't you do it, because Jerusalem is going down. So flee despite what others may be doing or you're thinking. And you know, it's interesting that the ancient Jewish historian Josephus, he tells us that when Jerusalem actually fell, something like 1 million Jews were killed, very few Christians. And I think it's because they listened to what Jesus told them here and from the disciples as they passed that along. Jesus goes on to speak of this in verses 17 and 18. So he says, "Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house, and let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes." In those days, they used the roofs as a living space in their house. Jesus says, if you're up there, don't go down to pack your bags first if you see the Roman armies. If you're out in the field working, don't go back to get your stuff. Get out of town. In fact, Jesus also says in verses 19 to 20, "But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath." Woe to the pregnant and nursing mothers, because fleeing will be especially difficult for you. And pray that it doesn't happen in winter, because it will also be especially difficult for you given the weather. And also pray that it's not on the Sabbath. Not because fleeing isn't permitted on the Sabbath, but because of all the man-made rules the Jews had concocted about the Sabbath, the Christians weren't going to get any help from them if it happened to be on the Sabbath. And you see, the reason Jesus says all of this is because the destruction that the Romans were going to bring to Jerusalem would be unparalleled in its history. Verse 21, "For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be." Now, as Jesus then says in verse 22, the days of the war will be shortened so that the Christians won't be destroyed, provided that they flee, of course. Now, Jesus won't allow the war to extend throughout the entire land. It will only be in Jerusalem, so those who flee will be safe. But nonetheless, it will be Israel's darkest hour. And the physical suffering will be unlike anything they would ever encounter. And again, this is where the Jewish historian Josephus is helpful. For example, he talks about the famine that happened to the city because of the Roman armies surrounding them. It was so bad that parents were even led to the extreme of infant cannibalism. That's how bad it was. And then that's not to mention that when they actually came into the city, how monstrous the slaughter was. But more than the physical suffering, Israel was being cut off as the people of God in this. And that's far worse than any disease or affliction we could suffer. But you see what's going on here. Besides telling the disciples what to do when they see the Romans arrive and why they should do it, Jesus is ensuring them, when the end has come, you will know it. It won't be when you hear these things. It won't be when you're persecuted. It won't be when the false Christs are showing up. It will be when the Roman armies get to town. And when they get to town, everyone will see it. And the same thing is true for the second coming of Jesus at the end of the age. No one will miss it. And Jesus goes on to speak of this. Verse 23, "Then if anyone says to you," right, in that time of tribulation, "if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, don't believe it. False Christs and false prophets will rise." Verse 25, "See, I have told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, he's in the desert, don't go out. Or he's in the inner rooms, don't believe it." Right. So in those days of tribulation, when the Roman army was there, there'll be false Christs. Most likely they're trying to offer some hope to get these people out of turmoil, some deceptive hope. They'll even be doing signs and wonders to prove they're the Messiah. Of course, these are deceptions brought about by Satan. And when they do, there'll be people telling others to come see. He's in the desert. He's in the inner room. Jesus says, don't listen to a word of it. Because when I actually come again to judge the world at the end of the age, nobody is going to miss it. That's what he says in verse 27. "For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be." The disciples nor we are to listen to any claims that the Christ has come in secret, because the coming, the real coming, will not be secret. It will be noticed by all. And so Jesus sums up this section in verse 28 by saying, "For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together." Now, it could be that he's referring to Jerusalem as the carcass and the Roman armies as the eagles, because the Roman armies on their emblem was an eagle. Very well could be in his mind. But I think given the connection, the immediate connection with verse 27, and the fact that the Greek word can be translated vulture instead of eagle, I think that the point Jesus is making here is that as obvious as it is to see where a dead animal is because of the vultures hovering above, so obvious will it be at the second coming. You can't miss it. And then as we see, fourthly, at that time, there will be great punishment as well as deliverance. And so we continue. Let's look now at verse 29. Jesus says, "Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken." Now, I know we're especially getting into some verses here where we read these and we've read them a long time and we always think they're talking about the second coming of Christ. And yet, we need to remember Jesus' words in verse 34. These are things that will happen within the lifetime of the disciples. And even though Jesus is using language that seems to be speaking about the end of the world and the heavenly lights not shining anymore, he's really just borrowing the language of judgment from the Old Testament prophets. And he's borrowing the language from the Old Testament prophets that they used to speak of judgment, not necessarily at the end of the world, but on particular nations at that time. And so I've given you a couple examples on your outline. The first one is Isaiah 13:10. All right, so here, this is speaking of the judgment that God was going to bring upon Babylon years ago. And it says, "For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine." Another example is Isaiah 34:4. And here, it's speaking about the judgment that God was going to bring about Edom at that time. And it says, "All the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled up like a scroll. All their hosts shall fall down, as the leaf falls from the vine, and as fruit falling from a fig tree." And there are other examples we could look at as well. But what Jesus is doing here is that, like the Old Testament prophets, use these symbolic words and images to speak of judgment coming on particular nations, Jesus is using those same symbolic words and images to speak of judgment to come on the particular nation of Israel in his day. And it's actually this prophetic imagery that helps us realize that he's not just talking about the end of a building or the end of a city, but the end of a power structure. Jesus is punishing them for rejecting him. And the punishment, he is really doing away with their whole way of life. He's removing the temple worship. He's bringing an end to the independence that they had as a people. And by tearing them down, he was at the same time making way for his kingdom to take its place, which is what Jesus then goes on to speak of in verse 30. Right, "Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." And again, we think that Jesus here is talking about his second coming. And yet, what we need to realize is that the sign here is one that proves the Son of Man is in heaven. So it's again easier to see in the Greek. He's not talking about a sign that will appear in the heavens at the end of the age. He's talking about a sign that proves the Son of Man is in heaven. Right? And that sign that proves the Son of Man is in heaven, Jesus says, is the destruction of Jerusalem. And when the Jews see it, they, the tribes of the earth, will mourn, because they will realize what they have done. That Jesus was the Messiah, but they didn't receive him. They rejected him. They killed him. After all, they knew that Jesus prophesied the destruction of the temple. People were teasing him about it when he was on the cross, Matthew 27:40. And so seeing it actually happen will remind them of what he had said and how he was who he claimed to be, the promised Son of Man, who's now reigning and ruling at the right hand of God the Father in heaven. Because as Jesus goes on to say, when they see the sign, when they see Jerusalem being destroyed, they will also see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And here we need to understand, this is a coming not from heaven to earth. It is a coming from earth to heaven. And the reason we know that is because there's only one other place in the Scriptures of the Old Testament that say these exact words, the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. And that's Daniel 7, verses 13 to 14. And so this passage, Daniel 7, needs to guide our understanding of Matthew 24:30. And so in Daniel 7, 13 and 14, we read, "I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came," where? "To the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and in his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed." That's talking about Jesus' ascension. After he accomplished salvation and was exalted by the Father, seated at his right hand, ruling and reigning over all. And that's what Jesus is talking about in verse 30 as well. His coming on the clouds to heaven and his ascension as king. And when Jerusalem is destroyed, Jesus says the Jews will see this. We often, when we're talking to one another, will say, "You see what I mean?" But we're not asking, "Did you see something with your eyes?" We're saying, "Did you understand what I mean?" Right? And that's what Jesus is getting at here. When they see Jerusalem being destroyed, they will see, they will know, they will understand that He is that Messiah King who's now reigning from on high. And as He does, He's delivering His elect and He's giving them His blood-bought salvation. And that's what Jesus says in verse 31. And He will send His angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together His elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. And again, the picture here is not of the second coming. We see, yes, the trumpets are spoken of in the Bible to herald the second coming, and that's true. But they're also used in the Bible to speak of the year of Jubilee, right? The year of liberty and redemption. So I've given you Leviticus 25, 8 to 10. Where we read, "And you shall count 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, and the time of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. Then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement you shall make the trumpet to sound throughout all your land." And of course, the year of Jubilee was a type of the liberty and redemption that Jesus had come to accomplish and win for His people in the fullness. And as He reigns from on high, that's what He is doing. He's sending forth His messengers. Now, it says angels in the New King James Version. The Greek word could easily be translated either way. And it is translated both ways in the New Testament. So He sends forth His messengers to proclaim the gospel. That's us. And through them, not just from the Jews, but from all parts of the world, from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other, He's calling forth sinners to Himself and giving them that freedom from their bondage and life everlasting. And so too, the destruction of Jerusalem, as it brings about great judgment upon the wicked, it also brings about great deliverance for God's elect. And the same thing is true with the second coming. We'll see this in a couple weeks in chapter 25. That when Jesus comes again to judge the living and the dead, He will separate the sheep from the goats. And He will say to the goats, those who did not trust and accept in Him as Savior, He will sentence them to eternal punishment. But for the sheep, those who accepted Him as Savior and as Lord, He will bring them into the glories of heaven for all eternity. And so therefore, as we come now to our final point, we need to flee from the judgment to come, and we need to warn others to do the same. And so, verse 32, Jesus continues, "Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near at the doors." Now, we look outside, we don't see leaves on the trees, we know summer's far away. And yet, as we see the leaves on the trees, we begin to realize summer's at hand. That's what Jesus is saying here. Just as leaves on a fig tree would signify that summer is around the corner, so too the Roman armies and the tribulations that they will bring signify that Jerusalem's fall is about to happen. And even though He's already made it crystal clear for them that it will happen, He wants to make sure one more time, and so He ends the discourse with these words, "Assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but My words will by no means pass away." Now He's starting to transition here to what He'll say in verses 36 and following about the second coming. But in doing so, He assures them, "My word is true. All that I've said to you about this is certainly to come to pass." And you know, as we look back in history, that's what happened. 66 AD, the Jews revolted against the Roman occupiers. That then led to a 7-month siege upon Jerusalem by the Roman armies, led by General Titus. The city was burned. The temple was demolished, stone by stone, just as Jesus had said it would be. If you go to Jerusalem today, you won't find any of it. You'll find the foundation of the temple, what they call the Weeping Wall, a part of it. But you won't find a temple or anything else. Because it happened exactly as Jesus said. And just as that happens, so too will the second coming and the judgment of all the world at the end of the age. We read these verses earlier this morning, but Acts 17:30-31, when Paul's preaching, he says, "Truly, these times of ignorance God overlooked, but now commands all men everywhere to repent. Why? Because He has appointed a day on which He will judge the world in righteousness by the man whom He has ordained." When I was in music school at IU, I occasionally had to play in the orchestra for operas. And you may know that operas at IU are kind of a big deal. So before we would have a performance, we'd have a dress rehearsal. And even though we pretended that it was, the dress rehearsal was not the real performance. And it was not exactly like the real performance either, given all the mistakes that would be made in it. But nonetheless, the only reason we had the dress rehearsal is because there would be a real performance. The destruction of Jerusalem is the dress rehearsal. It wasn't the final judgment. It wasn't exactly like the final judgment, but it points us to the reality that there will be a final judgment. And so we should be left with the same question in our minds that the disciples were left in their minds. What are we to do? And we are to flee just as they were to flee. You may remember when John the Baptist was baptizing people in Matthew 3, preparing the way for the Lord, and he saw the Pharisees and the Sadducees come to him, and they wanted to be baptized. You remember what Jesus or John said to them? "Brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come?" And so we are to flee. And yet, instead of running to the hills, we're to run to Jesus Himself. This is where it's important for us to realize Jerusalem was punished because they rejected Jesus. That's why. And we will be punished if we reject Jesus as well, but not if we accept and trust in Him. Because like the mountains were a refuge for the disciples, Jesus is a refuge for us. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever believes in Him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And that's true not just for us, but for everyone. Which is why, unlike the false prophets who were trying to lead everyone astray in their day, we must tell them with love, with care, with prayer, that we know judgment is coming. And as we'll see next week, we don't know when exactly it will come. And so we need to be ready, and we need to flee. And so let us this evening take heed to Jesus' words. Judgment is coming. Have you fled from it? Will you flee from it? And let us do that, and let us warn others to do the same. Let's pray.